Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and I am extremely excited to be joined by the climate journalist Eric Holthaus. He's a writer at The Correspondent, and his writing has also appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Slate, and Grist. And now he's written his first book. It's called The Future Earth, A Radical Vision for What's Possible in the Age of Warming. It's coming out from HarperCollins on June 30th. Eric Holthaus, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really a great honor.
Now, I know you are a lifelong Midwesterner and so genetically humble, so I'm going to do my best to limit how much I ask you to talk about yourself. But I do want to begin biographically. And specifically, I'd like to go back to August of 2018, because that's when you published a cover story at Grist. It was titled Courage and Bolt Cutters, Meet the Next Generation of Climate Activists. And that same day, you tweeted that writing that story quite literally changed your life. And so I wondered if you could share with our listeners a bit about your background and how reporting on contemporary climate activism has transformed your thinking and presumably has led you to write this book.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. That's a really brilliant starting point. Because I think the world was just in the early days of what... we would probably call the new abnormal now. It feels like right around then, I think AOC had just won her primary. Greta Thunberg was in her early days of her strike. The IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees was coming out in October. So it was just before that. Me as a journalist focusing on climate, up until that point, I had been writing full-time on climate for about 8 years or so. And I feel like I was just lost, honestly. Like, in hindsight, it feels like I was lost. It feels like I was looking for something to tie it together, because I had this disconnect that really brought me to journalism in the first place. It was sort of this burning mismatch between what climate scientists were saying and what was happening in the world. It very, very clear since the 80s at least, and probably since the 70s, that there was only sort of a radical deviation from business as normal would effectively address environmental concerns. Going back to the first Earth Day in 1970, which was still one of the largest mass movements of people in the world globally, which is shocking sort of still to see that holding up as a major turning point in world history. But now, 50 years later, we're still sort of caught in this weird mismatch between what we know needs to happen, which is sort of a rejection of industrial extractive capitalism, which has its roots, you know, 500 years ago in colonialism and racism and all the other reasons that wealth has been accumulated and concentrated into the hands of very few super powerful people now, that has put us on this sort of global trajectory where it can't, like, the idea of economic growth for growth's sake cannot be questioned. I feel like all that changed sort of in the last few months of 2018, or maybe started to change in a new way. I think that for me, that was a moment where it started to become a little bit clear. I was asking myself, you know, and climate journalists for decades were asking themselves, what is it going to take for this mismatch to be resolved between where what we know needs to happen and what is happening? And I think, you know, what I say in the book and what I think thought really clearly for probably the first time that fall was, we need a vision or visions of the near future. What is it going to feel like and look like to be deviating from the world? Like, what are we actually fighting for, not just what we're fighting against? And I think that is starting to come into popular knowledge with the idea of a Green New Deal as being recentering the climate movement as a movement for justice, not just a movement for decreasing carbon emissions or, you know, abolishing the fossil fuel industry or, you know, saving endangered species or all of those things are necessary, but that's not, that can't be the end goal in and of itself, because you don't build a movement by fighting against something. You build a movement by fighting for something. And I think that we're starting to see finally in the last 18 months or so, the emergence of climate change as at its core, a justice movement. We are fighting for a world where everyone matters. We are fighting for a world where every living thing matters, and that we realize that we have a chance to remake the playing field globally in every part of the world, to recognize that we all exist in an ecosystem together. All of our actions depend on the actions of each other. We are now, for the first time in human history, literally connecting our actions physically to each other through carbon emissions. What our choices on a daily basis physically affect people all around the world every day. And there's accumulation of those choices in the weather that we experience. No matter what the weather is outside today, wherever you are listening to this from, it is different because people have chosen to do certain actions that result in emission, in carbon emissions over the past few hundred years. No weather anywhere in the world at any moment is what it would have been without that. So we have this sort of visceral reminder that we are all connected now, which I don't think has really existed before, ever. And I think, you know, that in the combination with coming with a name and a vision for what the future could look like, what it would look like if people matter. Now that we have that, I feel like everything's on the table. Again, we can imagine what that transformative change needs to be now. That was the main driving force behind this book.
And as you say, the book is primarily dedicated to describing a future, and sort of each, it's structured so that each section, you're painting a mural of a decade from here to mid-century. But you begin the book with this whirlwind survey of the toll climate change is taking around the world right now. You write that in a matter of months, it seems that climate change has moved from something that was supposed to happen in the future to something that is causing immediate and irreversible damage across the planet. I wonder if you could just share a couple of those effects, a couple of examples of this damage that perhaps not enough of us, even good liberals who, you know, believe in and care about climate change, are aware of.
Sure. So the personal story that I share in this book is that, and this book started, about 5 years ago, actually, and this is the third iteration of this project. So I rewrote the book twice to come with this.
Wow.
Partly because, I started the book right when we were having our first kid, and that is not a great time to start a book. So that original iteration backfired a little bit. I just couldn't get it done in time, and we had to scrap the project, and then reboot with another team, about a year later. But this has been a very, very personal project for me, in that it happened amid, my two babies and then a divorce and then moving across the country and then, the election of Donald Trump and then the emergence of the Green New Deal and sort of like sorting all of this out in my head. And I think that it's absolutely not necessary for you to have your own kids to understand all of this. But it does make your time during the day a little bit more compressed and focused. So I was writing this book actually in the evenings after my kids were in bed, or on the weekends when I could have the kids with a babysitter or with their mom, or I feel like I was stealing time to write the book. And I felt like that urgency sort of helped focus the words in the book a little bit to say, think of climate change not as a distant abstract problem, but an urgent reality that sort of permeates every aspect of our life, whether or not we want to admit that right now. So one of the scenes that I have in the first few pages of the book is me and my oldest son, Roscoe, out with my dad at my family's farm in Kansas, walking along this creek. And we see this like beaver poke up through a hole in the ice. And my dad just told this story. He's like, yeah, this used to happen all the time and it doesn't anymore. And I know those are these cliche intergenerational climate stories that probably everyone has, but it just sort of like focused it for me a little bit to see that this same thing is playing out in basically every family everywhere in the world right now. It's not a normal thing for, our planet to be going through a few hundred thousand years worth of change in a span of a single human lifetime. Like, it's not something that humans are built to know how to deal with. We are, right now have the most carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at any point since modern humans evolved, like 4 or 5 million years ago. So we just don't know biologically what this world is that we're in right now. There's no real frame of reference for our human brains to understand it. And that's what I think I try to talk about in that first section of the book, is that these are we think of climate disasters as, typically if it's covered in the news, as statistics or how much damage was created or how many people were killed, but this is sort of an ongoing trauma that everyone is feeling, especially people who have been marginalized by society. This is something that permeates life. And I think the best way to think about climate change is as an active sort of ongoing trauma that everyone is dealing with rather than as a scientific problem. This is just another, thing that we will have to, wrap our brains around. What it is like to be human, requires us to understand what it's like to be alive in a moment of geological history where the world around us is changing faster than we are able to perceive. So I try to humanize some of these events a little bit and talk about how the people who are dealing with them are dealing with them, what it feels like, what that that lingering anxiety feels like. For me personally, I started counseling specifically because of climate anxiety during the process of writing this book. I think a lot of people listening probably have, you know, maybe felt a need to do something similar or to sort of feel yourself all of the sudden at a breaking point and not really know how to name it. I think that's normal for what everyone is going through right now. I don't think it's rare, even though it feels rare maybe, because it's not something that we're encouraged to talk about. And I guess my invitation to readers in this first one third of the book is to think of it that way. Think of climate change as a trauma. And think of it as something that will take your entire lifetime to process. And it's okay if you're on whatever part of that process you're in at any given time is okay, because it's not something that can be quote unquote solved ever. It's going to be our reality for the rest of our life. Even if we do everything we need to do, it's still going to be here. We'll still have to know that this problem was created and exists. Yeah, and I think that's a little bit different than the typical climate book.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
And then as the book begins the perspective tour of the next three decades, you write that the period from 2020 to 2030 will be both a truly terrifying and a golden era in humanity. And the spark for this new era is a really bad 2020, which kudos to you for forecasting that already. In your version of this dark 2020, you speculate about a year of overlapping storms and fires and floods and droughts and all of the cascading damage of these disasters. You know, for instance, you have a hurricane that hits South Florida, the big one, and that then in turn causes the collapse of multinational insurance companies, which then in turn throws the financial global financial system into crisis. And then you also, in quite a flourish, you have a freak hurricane hitting D.C. just as Americans are headed to the polls this November. It's all very awful to imagine, even though we've been kind of desensitized to awful things so far this year. It doesn't seem as far-fetched, right? These are things that we are used to happening. Just if they were to all happen in 1 year, that would be quite a shock. I wonder why you decided to begin the book, your vision of the future in this way. And, do you expect it'll take a synchronous arrival of plagues to precipitate political action?
It's really weird that I did that because honestly, what's happening in the real 2020 is pretty much exactly as I wrote this, like, extreme weird sci-fi world. I mean, I didn't anticipate it would be like a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Or a resurgent civil rights movement. But we are, the latest numbers show that we are headed on track for the warmest year in history this year, which was a little unexpected. I think when the year started, we were expecting to be in the top 5 for sure, but it was unlikely we would be number 1. And there is a little bit of theory here, and I get into this actually in the last section of the book, the section on the 2040s, talking about how with a very, very quick reduction in emissions, we could actually see an increase in temperature because industrial aerosols have a net cooling effect on the climate. So by reducing air pollution, you actually warm the planet. And we are seeing a little bit of that this year. I think, you know, the science is still out on the exact connection. It's not, I haven't seen any papers on it yet, but I know that there are climate scientists that are studying this right now, that we have seen this surge of a tenth of a degree or so, which is a lot in the span of 3 or 4 months. And that is causing, an overlapping uptick in climate disasters, that the potential that the shutdown related to the pandemic has worsened the climate disasters that otherwise would have happened this year if we end up on the warmest year in history. So that, you know, I wrote this as sort of a natural extension of the climate strikes and everything that was happening. I finalized the text of the book in January of 2020. So it was sort of the amount right around the time where it was clear that the coronavirus was going to be a big deal in China. It wasn't yet clear that it was going to become a global pandemic. And I think I in one of my very last edits mentioned the coronavirus just very briefly.
Yes, it jumps off the page at you. Yeah.
Yeah. But as I was writing it, this book version of the year 2020 was sort of like I was thinking of it like as there needs to be something that really broadens the climate movement in the next year or two in order to get us on path to have a sort of transformative 10-year period. We need to have something that sort of shocks us into having the climate movement become part of the broader justice movement. That has definitely happened, I think, in the real world, in the real 2020. And I think that it's sort of like and I kind of regretted having to do it this way after the book was done, of saying like, yeah, only a disaster will wake us out of our senses. Like that seemed sort of like the cliche approach to basically every Hollywood climate movie in history. But I didn't want to speculate on things being too specific. You know, I didn't want to say like, you know, Bernie Sanders will be the nominee and we will have, you know, a 6-month sit-in general strike because he will start a revolution or so. Like that seemed way too specific, although that seemed more likely than a pandemic, you know, in January. In my like in my reluctance to be too specific, I ended up just creating a whole bunch of climate disasters. But I think, you know, the outcome of this year could be very similar to what I have in the book, in that we could, by the end of the real 2020, end up with a world where the climate movement is broadly aligned to a very resurgent global justice movement on almost every justice issue that the movements are aligned and working together. And there will be, it looks like, hopefully, a window in early 2021 for a very, very radical shift, not just in U.S. climate policy, but global climate policy. It seems like we will have an opportunity to kickstart the Green New Deal, hopefully, in a way that is similar to what I have in the book. So I hope that prediction comes true.
One of the fascinating things is that you have this bad 2020 leading to, you know, this amped up version of the Green New Deal, but you also imagine that we might all come to realize we need, as you put it, democracy to work better. And so you also imagine Congress ending up approving an array of sort of long awaited structural reforms that are not, you know, front and center in the climate agenda, from, you know, statehood to DC and Puerto Rico and the Pacific Island territories, to abolishing the filibuster and term limiting the Supreme Court and increasing sovereignty for all Native nations. Why do you think that the climate catastrophe might be the catalyst for these long awaited things, and what good might they do in the warming world?
I think that anything that helps democracy to work better is fundamentally a climate policy or a climate solution. I think that the problem of climate change isn't necessarily a problem of emissions, though of course it is. It's really a problem of marginalized voices not being heard. The way the U.S. democracy is structured is unfair to people at the front lines of climate change. I think that's pretty balanced and fair assessment that that climate policy in the U.S. right now doesn't reflect even the median voter in the U.S. Especially in the last 18 months, Green New Deal style climate policies pull very, very well. I think it's something that people are on board with across party lines. Now, getting it actually in place is the problem. Yeah. So any structural reforms to democracy in the U.S. can only be of benefit to the climate movement, I think.
And then you also look beyond the U.S. and globally. Yeah. when you envision a just transition, you have a really crucial role being played by the courts. And why is that? And how might that work?
Yeah. Yep. I think that that we're starting to see the court systems globally. You know, there was a key court case last year in the Netherlands, Urgenda, that sort of defined climate change as stable climate as a fundamental human right for the first time at a national Supreme Court level in the Netherlands, and that there that decision was structured in a way where it could apply to the entire EU. And if it applies to the entire EU, then it could, in theory, if the EU wants it to, could apply to the rest of the world, because you could have a system set up where, you know, any sort of EU trade deal has to be carbon neutral, or else you can't trade with Europe. Like, I feel like that would pretty much put other countries very quickly in line for major changes. And I think that's the thing, that's a theme throughout this book, is that change can happen much quicker than we think it can. If you read the last few pages of the book, and I've done this to myself in the editing process of this book, if you read the last few pages just on its own as an island, it's like, what the heck? You know, pretty far out there. But if you take the next 30 years as a series of, you know, 6-week windows of change, mm-hmm. and if every one of those windows sort of falls in line the way it needs to, then it can happen even potentially more quickly than what I have it here in the book. So You know, and we're in that world now where we can start to see in the first 6 months of 2020 what it might look like to see rapid change happen in real time. So I think, you know, 3 or 4 years is actually a very, very long time. You can imagine what has happened in the US since early 2016. It's almost unrecognizable in some ways where our country is now. So I think that same thing can and will happen over the next decade. And I think that, you know, the courts will play a big role in that. I think that, protest movements, you know, I talk in the book a lot about the Sunrise Movement or in general, justice aligned movements that are fighting for a Green New Deal as being very, very important. You know, when I wrote this book, I didn't expect the school strikes to completely fall off the map overnight, which happened because of the pandemic. But, you know, I think that the Zoomers are super smart and that they will come up with something else that is even more useful than the school strikes were. So all of that stuff can and will happen. And I think that really, you know, yeah, again, in the first third of the book, I'm trying to just prime the reader to open to this sort of necessity of radical change, both because the climate science demands it and because it's possible, you know, studies of civil rights movements throughout the last at least 100 years of history show that it's possible. And in fact, almost likely, if you get a critical mass, that they will succeed in achieving their goals. That research comes from Erica Chenoweth, who I also cite, who has kind of become sort of this figurehead of the climate movement. I know Sunrise Movement cites Erica Chenoweth's work a lot, saying that you need about 3.5% of the general population out in the streets to sort of put forward change that if you study past social movements over the last 100 years or so, nonviolent social movements that have reached that threshold have almost universally achieved their goals.
When you get us to the 2030s, we get the good news that the world will be past peak emissions. The U.S. will be close to, by the middle of the decade, it'll be carbon neutral. And yet you say it will not be time for high fives, unfortunately. Rather, it's at this point in the book, and this point in the narrative, that you imagine we'll come to recognize we must leave capitalism behind. You know, why is it? Why is that? And why in that order? And, you know, what comes next?
Yeah, I think that in my mind, I have the 2030s as a moment of triage in world history, where we're sort of assessing what can be salvaged and what can't, and we are just throwing things out that haven't worked for hundreds of years, and we are in the middle of a moment of chaos. And I think actually, in hindsight, if we do that work without doing the work simultaneously of building up a vision for what comes next, it could get very, very bad. And that is the dystopia scenario that I have chosen to exclude from this book. If we end up on January 1st, 2030 and say, okay, we have an electrical grid in the US that is 100% carbon neutral, and we are on our way to providing the basic needs for not only survival, but a thriving human existence for everyone on Earth, that we are sort of leveling the playing field and participating in reparations and sort of all of the demands of the climate movement in the global South. That's the first step. You know, in some ways that's the easiest step to do, is to just sort of diagnose what's going wrong and attempt a Band-Aid fix to just stabilize ourselves. Replacing that, saying what's next, replacing the system that we have with a system that is better or that could work for everyone, I think will be a messy process. That's actually the hardest thing that we have to do over the next 30 years, I think, is come up with sort of a world where we don't have an economic system that is imposed on the vast majority of humanity, and that's not extractive, that instead is models sort of what I would call an ecological approach to economic system, where we recognize that that all of our work, all of our actions can affect each other. And the goal actually is not to make money. The goal is to sort of live a good life for everyone and to make sure that non-human species also have the chance to live a good life. And it's actually possible with far fewer emissions than what we currently have. There are a lot of luxury emissions that are unnecessary right now, just because of the way the economic system is structured with capitalism. There's a lot of waste inherent in capitalism. And so I think, in that book, or in the book, in that section, the starting in the 2030s, I have an interview with Kate Raworth, whose book, Donut Economics, was really important to me. And I try to have her expand on that vision a little bit, by thinking about, what it would look like in that world where the donut becomes sort of like the governing principle of the world, where we are simultaneously living within ecological boundaries and simultaneously putting a hard floor on standard of living everywhere in the world for every person. So we are upholding human rights, we are upholding environmental integrity at the same time. And I think that kind of world has entirely different metrics, entirely different aims. It's focused on cooperation. It's not focused on competition. I think that, I also talk about the concept of ownership changes. Like it doesn't really have, we don't really own you don't really own things. You are stewards of them in that world. It's like a philosophical and spiritual revolution. So, we've very quickly in this conversation gone from the Sunrise Movement to a global religious revival. I think as it's happening, it won't really feel strange. I think it will just feel like, oh yeah, this makes sense. This is what we were actually trying to do the whole time. And I also talk, one of the things that, that Kate Raworth says to me is that this system shouldn't have a name. It shouldn't really have a label. It's not capitalism or socialism or anything. It's just not anything yet because it hasn't been really, we haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about it. Anyone has. I don't know that there are that many people focused on trying to foster the conversations that are necessary to develop sort of like culturally and locally appropriate economic systems that can be sort of networked together in a post-carbon world. I would love to work with those people if, and I'm sure they exist, and I'm sure that they just aren't getting enough attention for the work that they're doing. So that's the kind, those are the kind of narrative building exercises that I think are actually so important right now in the year 2020, so that we are ready for 2030 when it comes time to sort of be building up rather than just tearing down.
When it comes to imagining a role for new technologies in the future, you are judicious and sparing. You know, there's no, you really resist the temptation of the deus ex machina, you know. But then when you get to the 2040s, when the world has already done so much right in your vision, that's when you predict we'll have to resort to geoengineering. And I wondered what you think, what would force our hand there? How might it help? And what are the many different kinds of risks involved?
Yeah, and I was just rereading this part yesterday, actually. I think that you know, I feel like throughout that 2040s chapter, I'm very critical of geoengineering and want to be sure that no one can mistake my words here of saying that it's a good idea. like sort of full stop. I think that it might be a bad idea and we do it anyway. I think that's where I come to in the end. Because we, you know, there's a 50-year lag built into climate change, where even if the world goes zero emissions, and this is what I alluded to earlier in this podcast, is that if you radically reduce emissions globally, we have about a half a degree Celsius baked in of warming from the aerosol effect, from air pollution. And I talk about that a little bit in this section in the 2040s to say that there is a risk that if we do too good, or if we do too well at reducing emissions, that we could actually end up with a span of a decade or so where it becomes a lot worse, where climate disasters become a lot worse. And in the book, I say, you know, there's a partial collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet in the late 2030s. And so you have now rapidly rising sea levels, hurricanes that are stronger than ever before, heat waves that are stronger than ever before. But you have done 20 years of investment into a Green New Deal and to rapidly reducing inequality around the world, where you have a baseline standard of living in every country that is, you know, sort of on par with everyone having their basic needs met, and then some, hopefully, with a carbon footprint that is just a tiny fraction of what it is today. So we have succeeded in large terms at what our goals were, but yet the weather is still getting worse.
Now, in the book, you have so many wonderful sources, you know, folks who, scholars and activists, you know, whom you converse. And I wanted to invite you to generally, you know, any conversations you had that you're particularly fond of remembering, or really that you just come out and say, I'd love to hear what it was like to host Greta Thunberg and her dad at your house.
Yeah. it was strange. I think that, it was sort of an unexpected thing where I was in touch with her over a period of a few months. Wanted to find a way to connect, when she was in the US. And I just sort of offered a pit stop for them to stay the night while they were moving through. And she accepted. So, it really honestly was just like having anyone else over to, that was the shocking, it shouldn't have been shocking at all, really. I mean, like, you know, her and her dad are regular people, and that's what, you know, when she left, that was the main takeaway that I had, was this is a regular person filled with a beautiful spirit of humanity. And she is just being an authentic person, true to herself. and people can sort of transparently see that. That's what it is that makes her so powerful, is that she is just authentic. She's on the autistic spectrum, and I am as well. And I think maybe that's where we originally connected. And I could sort of see that little bit, that was familiar to me when she was here, of just sort of saying, oh yeah, like, it just makes sense to, what, like, why wouldn't you just be uncomfortable with the way the world is, because it's not working the way it should, and you can't really be quiet until you tell people that, and like, things fit together in your head in a way that don't really fit well together with everyone else, and you can't really understand why other people don't get it. So that was really important conversation, I think, and realization to have at that moment, you know, while she's sort of like out on a walk with me, my 5-year-old and my 3-year-old in the rain in St. Paul through our neighborhood. I actually think that the most important conversation to me was this conversation with Kyle White, who is an indigenous scholar and has worked for years with tribes in North America about relating with states, sort of trying to be an advocate for this this moment of transition, he helped me to realize that the narratives that I had been telling myself about climate change were just not seen as sort of transparently helpful in a different perspective, you know, with a different lived history, with a different set of historical experiences. And I think he said to me that, I'm not sure if it actually made it into the final version of the book, but he said, this whole concept of urgency, or the climate emergency, is actually very damaging from an indigenous perspective. Like, it's not a helpful narrative because, you know, for the last 500 years, anything that has happened quickly to us has been bad. And that's not something that we feel comfortable with usually. You know, he's speaking for himself here, I think, but that helped me a lot to think, like, you know, we have to think of our actions as existing throughout time, not just what feels like the right decision now, but we have to be constantly doing work on a 200 year time span as well. You have to be doing the slow work of relationship building and trust building, and focus on reestablishing a consent based relationship with your fellow humans, because if we don't live and work together, then we don't really have a civilization. And I think that is what helped me frame the entire premise of the book, really, in the sense that we need to be taking the long view in the middle of an emergency, because the emergency itself is very violent. I mean, the act of calling it an emergency, the act of thinking about it as an emergency, is violent. And yet still I use that word all the time. You know, I use that word on Twitter, and I use that in my writing, and I use it throughout this book still. So I have a lot of work to do. I mean, I have a lot of these, you know, this dissonance still to resolve in my head, and probably always will. But there's a lot that I realize that I don't know after finishing writing this book. But I think that one very, very important theme that conversation with Kyle White had for me is that we need to be thinking of the relationship building work that we're doing as a primary climate policy, or as a primary climate way of climate action. So if anything, if I could give a takeaway to anyone listening to this or to reading this book, it would be that the conversations that you have with other people in your life are the most important climate actions you will ever take in your life. It's that person-to-person relationship, telling and showing what matters to you is very, very important. Equally as important, if not more important, is making sure that the voices that you are being informed by are people who are different from you, because that's how change happens. The fact is that we are just really not talking about climate change at all, as a world and as a society, even though we in polling, in surveys, international surveys, climate ranks right at the top of global priorities, but yet we spend only, a few hours a year on the nightly news or on cable news talking about climate. And I know that cable news is not really a good proxy of conversation in the US, but it doesn't hurt to be talking about climate more, as much as you can, as much as you feel like people will listen to you, because it is a good frame for creating sort of a more just world, which I think is what hopefully everyone is trying to do.
Coming into this interview, I planned to close by asking you about how the events of the year since, in the time since you last touched the manuscript in January, have affected your thinking, and especially because you're there in the Twin Cities. But what you've mentioned so far about that, what surprised me about what you've said about that is that it sounds like you've been heartened by them, and buoyed and maybe increased your optimism about the changes that we need to make. And I guess I'd wonder, what would you say to somebody who sees these things as, obviously who's sympathetically sees obviously fighting a pandemic as being important and fighting, racist policing and this, as you called it, a resurgent civil rights movement is important. But in light of the fact that, we're not talking about climate change enough, why don't you see these things? Why are you inspired by them as opposed to seeing them as other urgent issues that are pushing climate behind, whether it's, in the national conversation, on airtime on TV, or also just on the left, as far as priorities. And so why aren't these distractions in the climate fight?
Yeah, I don't think that the struggle for justice in any form is a distraction. I think that's what the climate movement is about. I think that if you have a more just world, then climate change is not a problem anymore. I can't conceive of a world that is fair and just that would continue to have a fossil fueled economy. This is my goal. In the end, sort of in the year 2050, in the world, in the universe that this book inhabits, we will look back on the last 30 years and wonder how it ever happened in the first place. Like, because it if you build a society and a global civilization where not caring for each other is unthinkable, climate change can't exist in that world. And I think that we would put ourselves on better footing for, other emerging justice issues that might happen over the next 100 years or so. We can set ourselves up by solving the climate emergency with a justice focused approach. we can prevent other injustices from happening in the future, because we are going to have a future after climate change. Like, the world is not going to end, you know, when the world reaches a certain degree Celsius threshold. We will still be dealing with things like, you know, AI and the colonization of the solar system. And like, if you're a future optimist, like, those things will potentially happen over the next 200 years. We need to figure out a way for having conversations. Yeah, it's like, all of this is happening while there's a billionaire that is planning to single-handedly colonize Mars. Like, should that happen? I don't know. Like, probably not. You know, like, one other thing that happened while I was writing this book is I went to a one-day conference at the Library of Congress, the title of the conference was Decolonizing Mars. And, you know, there were Afrofuturists, there were planetary scientists, there were people that built Mars missions, there were all kinds of people there, journalists, artists, talking about what does this mean if you take the last 500 years of human history and put Mars colonization in that, and you have the hindsight of knowing what happened, probably it's not necessary. Like, Mars has rights. And if there are living things elsewhere in the solar system, they have rights too. Also, the act of spending money on Mars missions when we have, a pandemic and a global economic catastrophe and climate change is not really, a just decision. Our work on climate, with a multi-century perspective, our work on climate informs these sort of future justice issues as well.
The book again is The Future Earth, A Radical Vision for What's Possible in the Age of Warming. Its author is Eric Holthaus. It's out on June 30th, so grab your copy now. Eric, thank you so much for your time today and for this book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.